greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 90 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education and indoctrination right after this. Hey, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 40% of what you create and produce, and the government gets 60%. Now, that's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25%, and the government nets 75%. That means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more, or 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. And it's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. You produce 100% more and get 8% of it. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. Let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information. It answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is we're paying so much and receiving so little. And let me teach you how to do just that in our tax and status school. It's now available on compact disc for adult home education. To order your free general law CD package, just call direct. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Back in 1886, a fellow by the name of Zach Montgomery had been appointed or nominated for the post of Assistant Attorney General of the United States. And the Senate of the United States, as is their custom, interviewed this fellow. And they asked him what his view was on public education. So he told them. And they turned down his nomination. They turned down his nomination because he was against the public school system. Now today, the American public school system is the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. It is so well ingrained in American psyche today that if you said, I'm opposed to the public school system, people look at you like you're some kind of a pariah. So let me begin by saying that George Gordon is opposed to the American public school system. I'm an educator. I'm not opposed to education. I'm opposed to the wrong kind of education, and it's my contention that the education system is wrong education. And Zach Montgomery came to that conclusion based upon the statistics that he derived from the census of 1850, 1860, 1870, and 1880. And he said, what are the results of the public school system between 1850 and 1880 in the United States? And he said, it produces criminals, paupers, insanity, suicide, and murder. And he said it produces it at a prodigious rate, geometric. It grows geometrically. And the more money you spend on the public school system, the more criminals you'll have, the more poor people you'll have, the more insanity you'll have, the more suicide and murder that you'll have. If you want more criminals, paupers, insane, suicide, and murderers, spend more money on public education. Now, he came to that conclusion in 1886 in his testimony before the Senate committee. Then, after they turned him down, he wrote a little book. It's not much of a book. It's 100 pages or something like that. And it's called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate by Zach Montgomery. And here's what he said. He said, crime in parental and anti-parental school states compared. Now, notice the words parental school states and anti-parental school states, because we're going to see that term quite often. That is parental school states and anti-parental. The writer intends to offer no apology to the reading community for this publication. As soon would he think of apologizing to the slumbering inhabitants of a city in flames for attempting to disturb their rest by the vigorous ringing of a fire bell. Far better that they awake even in anger than to awake not at all. If the reader will but follow us, even to the extent of a few pages, we promise to demonstrate by incontestable facts and figures drawn from sources that will not be and cannot be impeached that the calamity at which we are endeavoring to alarm our countrymen is far more widespread and direful in its consequences than any conflagration that ever devastated any city. And we further promise to prove that our boasted New England public school system is now by law established throughout the length and breadth of the American Republic. It is a poisonous fountain fraught with the seeds of human misery and moral death. But, says the reader, how can that possibly be true? Can it be denied that an educated people are more moral and virtuous, more contented, happy, and law-abiding than an ignorant people? And if so, how can it be charged that a system of education which almost entirely banishes illiteracy from the land is fraught with so much evil in those who are brought under its influence? Well, now, these are candid questions, and they shall receive candid answers. It is very true that ignorance is the mother of vice, and it's also true that an educated people, if properly educated, are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, and law-abiding than an ignorant people. So thus far, we think there can be no difference of opinion between the most inveterate supporter of the New England public school system and ourselves. Now, keeping steadily in view this common standpoint, that is, namely, that a people properly educated are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, and law-abiding than an ignorant people, let us suppose, for the sake of our discussion, that we somewhere find, living side by side, two communities, one of which is made up almost entirely of educated people, while the other community is largely composed of illiterate people. Then, let us further suppose that amongst those considered educated, you find that in proportion to their population, they have six criminals, to where the more illiterate community has but one. Then, let's suppose that they have nearly two paupers in the educated community, to where the more illiterate people have but one. And then let's suppose that they have two insane people in this educated community, to where the illiterates have only one. And then let's suppose that their death list shows four suicides in this educated community, to where that of the illiterate shows but one. And then let's suppose that the same list shows three deaths from the criminal indulgence of a murderer in that educated community of the brutal passions, while that of the illiterate shows but two. What conclusion would you then arrive at with reference to that kind of education? Now, adhering to this proposition with which we set out a moment ago, namely that a people properly educated are, in fact, more moral, more virtuous, more contented, happier, and more law-abiding than an uneducated people, would you not then be forced to the conclusion that there must be something wrong, something terribly, radically, tragically wrong in a system of education so much more direful in its results than even the illiteracy itself? But just here, perhaps the reader will ask, as he has a right to, what application has your supposed case to the question under discussion? Just have a little patience, my friend, and you shall see the application. Because this educated community, let us take the native-born white population of the six New England states. Here they are: Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Six New England states. And for our unlettered, illiterate community, let us take all of the native-born whites of the six states of Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. Now, we should observe that the states thus enumerated are either a part of the original 13 colonies or such as have been carved out from them. Both of these communities started on their career of existence about the same time. Both of these two communities of states were composed mainly of people from the same part of Europe. These people all spoke the same language, and they'd all been accustomed to the same laws, the same manners, and same usages. People who possessed the same Christian religion, pretty much all of them outside of little Maryland, where the Protestant faith, and in Maryland they were of the Catholic faith. And they took as their religious guide the same Bible, and even the same translation of the Bible. Now, there's one important particular, however, in which these two communities widely differed at the very start, as we shall presently see. You see, more than 200 years ago, the principle was incorporated into the legislation of Massachusetts that the whole people must be educated to a certain degree at the public expense, irrespective of any social distinctions. So again, in Massachusetts, by statute, by law, in 1647, each town consisting of 50 householders was directed to maintain a school to teach their children to read and write, and every town of 100 families was to maintain a grammar school to fit youth for the college. The common schools of Massachusetts have been kept up to this day by direct tax and individual subscription. And nowhere in a population of equal extent has common elementary education been more universally diffused. The compulsory system of supporting common and grammar schools in each town is sustained to this day in Massachusetts, and it is enforced by indictment. You do it or go to jail. At a very early day after their settlement, a similar system of education was adopted in all of the other New England states, from which fact the system seems to have taken on the name of the New England system. Chancellor Kent says, "In New England, it has been a steady and governing principle from the very foundation of the colonies that it was the right and duty of government to provide by means of fair and just taxation for the instruction of all of the youth in the elements of learning." Now, on the other hand, the six enumerated states comprising what we have agreed to call the unlettered community steadily resisted the New England system up to a very recent date. Virginia, for instance, which occupies about the same relation to the latter community that Massachusetts does to the former, according to Lippincott's Gazetteer of the World, published in 1856, they had at that time no general free school system, but they made an appropriation for the instruction of the poor. Thus, these two communities, the one with its New England public school system and the other without it, traveled along side by side for 200 years until AD 1860, when the 8th United States decennial census was taken, and the following was shown of these two communities, as will appear by reference to the annexed table number 1. So we find at that date referred to wit, 1860, Massachusetts and her 5 New England sisters had 2.5 million native-born white inhabitants. And out of these, only 8,000 adults who could not read or write, while Virginia, with her 5 sisters, numbered 3 million native-born whites, of whom 260,000 adults could neither read nor write. So that the 6 New England states, the proportion of illiterate native whites was only 1 out of every 312. But in Virginia, and her 5 sisters, they counted 1 illiterate out of every 12. Now that's very dramatic. In the New England states, only 1 out of 300 could not read or write, but in Virginia, 1 out of every 10, or about 10% of the population, was illiterate. Now, let us take a look at the criminal lists. How stand the criminal lists? Well, in Massachusetts and her 5 sisters, out of her native white population of just a little more than 2.5 million, they had on the 1st of June 1860 just 2,500 criminals in prison, while Virginia and her 5 comparatively unlettered companions with a native white population of over 3 million had less than 500 in their prisons. That is to say, in those educated under the New England system, they had 1 native-born white criminal to every 1,000 native white inhabitants, while those who had generally rejected the system had but 1 prisoner to every 6,000 plus, being a disproportion according to the whole number of native whites of more than 6 criminals in New England to every 1 criminal in the southern states. Now, a glance at the same table will show that the natives educated under that New England system had 1 pauper, 1 poor person to every 178, while those who had managed to live without that luxury had but 1 pauper to every 345. Now, that's a 2-to-1 ratio. So when we look at crime in the New England states, they have 6 times more criminals than do the illiterate states in the South. And when we take a look at poverty, they have 2, twice as much poverty in the northern New England states than they did in the South. And of those who in 1 year had died by suicide, in New England, they had 1 suicide for every 13,000 of the entire population, while in Virginia and her 5 sisters, they had but 1 suicide to every 56,000. That's a 4-to-1 ratio. So suicide was 4 times more prevalent in the North among those that were educated than those in the South. And of those who perished, the victims of their criminal lusts, that is the murderers, New England had 1 murderer for every 84,000, while her neighbors that had never enjoyed her educational advantages had but 1 such victim to every 128,000. Now again, that's a 2-to-1 ratio. Now, we have not before us the list of insane in the several states for 1860, so we borrow from the report furnished by the census marshal of 1870, where it appears that the New England system produced, of those born and living in their native states, 1 insane person to every 800 native-born inhabitants, while the rejection of that system resulted in 1 insane to every 1,600 native inhabitants. That's 2-to-1. All right, so when we look at crime, it's 6-to-1. When we look at poverty, 2-to-1. When we look at murder, it's 4-to-1. And when we look at insanity, it's 2-to-1. We're not through yet. Bear with us. There's more to come. One very noticeable fact in this connection, as shown by the foregoing tables, is that in the state of Massachusetts, which claims the honor of being the founder of the New England system of education, while she had by far the smallest proportion of illiterate native-born adults of any given of New England state, she had at the same time much the largest proportion of native white criminals, having 1 criminal to every 649 native white inhabitants. Now, the nearest approach to her was the showing made by the state of Connecticut, where there was 1 native white criminal to every 845 native white inhabitants. And now, good reader, if you will take the pains to turn to the 6th column of figures in Table 3, keeping in mind that all of these documents, all of these tables, come from the Census Bureau of the United States, which shows the relative proportion of native-born white criminals in every state in the Union in 1860. You will see that Massachusetts stands alone in the grand and magnificent proportions of her criminal list. Now, California at that time came next to her chosen model, having one native-born white criminal to every 697 native whites, while as above, Massachusetts had one out of every 649. Now, California seems to have resolved, however, not to be surpassed in her crime list, even by her great exemplar, Massachusetts, for when the next decennial census reports were returned, to wit, in 1870, California made a showing of one native white criminal for every 512 native white inhabitants, thus carrying off the palm, which 10 years before had been awarded to the old state of Massachusetts. California now has taken over as number one, just 10 years later. Now, in view of the foregoing facts and figures, is it any wonder, then, that the Boston correspondent of the San Francisco Morning Call tells us that a large number of public school men have come to the conclusion that the public school system of that city is a failure? Or is it surprising that another of our leading dailies, the Alta Californian, speaking editorially of the same system as it exists in this state, California, calls it our anaconda and declares that if we are to judge this system by its fruits, we shall have to pronounce it not only a melancholy, but a most disastrous failure, and that it will be idle to look for the cause of the general rowdyism, idleness, and viciousness of the rising generation anywhere but in the training which it has been receiving in this public school system. Now, even after the Civil War, which raged with such terrible fury over the southern and southwestern United States during the years from 1861 to 1865, whereby property to the value of thousands of millions of dollars was destroyed, a servile race was emancipated, and the very foundations of the whole social and political fabric upheaved and broken to atoms. Even after all the bad government, which bad white men and bad black men had succeeded in forcing upon the subjugated states, still, when the census reports for 1870 were published, they showed that neither their native white criminals nor paupers counted in the proportion even of so much as one, to where those counted two who had been for 200 years subjected to the ravages of the New England public school system. Not even the Civil War and all of the attendant evil that went with it raised the crime level in the southern states anywhere near to that which it was in the north. And this precious system of education is the great boon for which, in 1870, the American people were paying to the tune of $64 million a year, while at the same time they were grinding through this mill of moral death no less than 7.5 million children. Now, in order to maintain this very same system, California alone expended during the last fiscal year no less than $2.5 million, as appears from the recently published biennial report of the state superintendent of public instruction. Indeed, so infatuated has our young state become with this crime and pauper breeding system of public instruction that California has made it a penal offense now for the parent or guardian of any child between the ages of 8 and 14 years to keep such child from these public schools, even for the sake of sending that child to a far better private school of his own choice and at his own expense, unless he first seeks and obtains the gracious permission of the school directors to do so. But lest the reader should be disposed to doubt the existence of so tyrannical a statute, here it is, as enacted by the California legislature on the 28th day of March in 1874. It says in Section 1 that every parent, guardian, or other person in the state of California having control and charge of any child or children between the ages of 8 and 14 years shall be required to send any such child or children to a public school for a period of at least two-thirds of the time during which a public school shall be taught in each city and county or school district in each school year, commencing on the first day of July, in the year of our Lord 1874, at least 12 weeks of which shall be consecutive, unless such child or children are excused from such attendance by the Board of Education of the city or city and county, or of the trustees of the school district in which such parents, guardians, or other persons reside, upon its being shown to their satisfaction that his or her bodily or mental condition has been such as to prevent attendance at school or application to study for the period required, or that the parents or guardians are extremely poor or sick, or that such child or children are taught in a private school or at home in such branches as are usually taught in the primary schools of this state, or have already been acquired a good knowledge of such branches, provided in case a public school shall not be taught for 3 months during the year, within 1 mile by the nearest traveled road of any person within the school district, he shall not be liable to the provisions of this act. Thus, it is that the votaries of this system have absolutely undertaken by the most tyrannical legislation to strip every parent of the guardianship of his children and to transfer their entire control to an irresponsible board of school trustees, so that if these school directors choose to appoint a libertine or a harlot as the tutor of your daughters, and at the same time refuse their gracious permission for you to send them to a private school of your own choice, it is with fines or prison dungeons that the law proposes to reward you, should you, in obedience to the dictates of right, reason, and your own conscience, seek to shield them from the contaminating touch of a vile teacher. So is it any wonder that vice flourishes, or that virtue perishes under the influence of such a system? Now, boys and girls, that was in 1886. The statute, of course, was enacted in 1874, but the book by Zach Montgomery called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, written by Zach Montgomery, was published in 1886. Well, now, if the school system was that bad back in the 1880s, what do you think it was in the 1980s? Well, what is it today? Well, we'll take a look at Jonas Yoder. We'll take a look at Yoder versus Wisconsin in the modern context today of the Amish, a community of people, farmers, religious folk, and compare their experience with the public school system of Wisconsin when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet daily. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, by Zach Montgomery. Now, the book is reprinted by the St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096. That's P.O. Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. First printing was 1968. Second printing was 1983. Now, the book was first published by Zach Montgomery back in 1886, copyrighted by Zach Montgomery in 1886, and published in the North American Review in December of 1880. So evidently it was an article published in the American Review in December of 1880, copyrighted by Zach Montgomery in 1886 and published by him in that year. Then it was reprinted by St. Thomas Press in 1968, and then reprinted a second time in 1983. Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, the School Question from a Parental and Non-Sectarian Standpoint. It's an epitome of the educational views of Zach Montgomery, compiled by himself from the United States Census Reports and from his own writing, Washington. It was published by Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders in 1886. It's called Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders. Now, this book is out of copyright a long time ago, and if you can find a copy in a used bookstore or from one of these sources, let me recommend that you get it. It's a real eye-opener. All right, now I said we would talk about the Amish experience at the break. Now let's take a look at a case called Yoder versus Wisconsin, in which this very same subject came up. Now, the Amish people have a unique way of life. They came here from Europe because of religious persecution, and they have set up their own communities. They're not all over the United States, but they're in certain areas of the United States, such as Ohio, Missouri, and Pennsylvania. And there are three big ones. There's also a big colony of them in Belize, the old British Honduras. And these people shun, that is, they use that word shun, they have elected not to use modern gadgetry like automobiles and chainsaws, telephones, computers, and things like that. They're farmers. Their vocation in life is farming. And as a result of that, they have a unique lifestyle. They make their own clothes. They farm. They make their livings. And they educate their children. Now, typically here in Missouri, at least the ones that we know of here, have their own schools. They have their own school teachers, and they teach their children in the public school format to the eighth grade. They formally educate them. But now, keeping in mind that these Amish schools aren't open to the general public. These are Amish schools, and they just have Amish students in them. So they don't have Catholics and Protestants and others in these Amish schools. And they do that for a reason. They don't want their children contaminated with the philosophies of Catholicism, Protestantism, and other religions. They don't want the politics of the Democrats or Republicans, and they don't want harlots and others educating their children. So they have their own Amish school teachers teaching them their Amish values. Now, in Wisconsin, they were doing this and up to the eighth grade, but now Wisconsin has a law, and it requires, and I suppose it still does, that you educate your children in public schools, public forum, until these children are 16 years old. Now, the Amish have a different view of this. And what they want to do is educate their children to the eighth grade. And I suppose if they had their druthers, they wouldn't educate them at all. They just plain would not teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic at all because they don't use it. What they use is bucking bales and milking cows and plowing fields and building fence and doing those things that farmers do. And in talking to one time, he said that therefore there isn't any need for calculus, geometry, and various other. Now, although they're great builders, the Amish people are great builders. They're carpenters. They're not plumbers and electricians. They don't plumb their houses and they don't electrify them. But they're good woodworkers and they're good carpenters and they know geometry. They understand angles. They don't have a problem building houses. But they don't need any engineers. They don't need any scientists. They don't need any paleontologists or archaeologists in their community. They don't use them. Don't need them. So a fellow by the name of Jonas Yoder jerks these two children out of the public school system in the eighth grade, and the school authorities came down and arrested him and jailed him and prosecuted him. And the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the state's position was, if these children are allowed to drop out of school in the eighth grade, they're going to turn out to be criminals. If they don't have a complete education, if they have this bad Amish education, they're going to end up being criminals. They will end up on the welfare rolls. They'll end up being paupers. They'll end up in insane asylums. These people are not going to be able to function in society if they don't have a public school education. That was the position that the state took. And the Amish came in and said, no, we don't think that's true. Hell, we've been doing this for 400 years, and we don't seem to have a problem with paupers, murderers, criminals, insane, suicide. We don't have that problem here. And so they put it to the test. So the justices at the Supreme Court, they asked the question, and the Amish people answered. So here's what the question was. If the state is correct that you're going to have a higher proportion or that you're going to have a lot of Amish criminals because they're not educated to the 10th grade in public school, the Amish came back and said, well, how many Amish men do you have, men and women, or for that matter, juveniles, locked up in the prisons in the state of Wisconsin? So they went out and they looked in all the prisons and all the jails and all the reform schools in Wisconsin looking for Amish people. And guess what they found? After they looked in every state penitentiary, looked in every county jail, looked in every city jail, looked in every reformatory, they could not find one single Amish person in those facilities. Not one. Now remember, Zach Montgomery pointed out that in the southern states, you know, Virginia, Georgia, North and South Carolina, Delaware, Maryland, that when they looked down there, they did find some criminals. This is back in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. They did find some, but proportionately, they were 6-1 less than they were up in New England. But there were some. But as recently as 1979 in Wisconsin, when they looked at a group of people who educated their children. Now, the Amish people educate their children. Don't believe for a moment now these people are uneducated. Amish people are educated. They're educated to milk cows. I don't think there's an Amish girl that can't milk a cow by hand. The Amish people make their own clothes. They breed cattle. They're great cattle breeders. They're great farmers. They build fences. They build houses. They build barns. They build buildings. See, these Amish people are educated. Every Amish boy can build. He can cut wood. He can work the angles. He can put on a 412 roof pitch. I mean, he knows what to do. In fact, I'm a general contractor, and I could not build like the Amish do. The Amish can go out and build a barn in a single day. They start at 6 o'clock in the morning. 12 hours later, they got a barn built. They can have as many as 600 workers working on that job site during that day. I can't even begin to imagine how you would organize 600 people for a 12-hour work shift. I haven't got a clue. I'm educated. Hell, I've been to public school. I can read and write. I know where Azerbaijan is on the map. Hell, I can find the Seychelles Islands, for crying out loud. And probably the average Amish man, he probably couldn't find the Seychelles Islands or the Turks and Caicos, for that matter. I can't. I'm called educated. But I couldn't even begin to start to organize 600 people. Wouldn't even try. I haven't got a clue. Amish can do it. All right, now that's the criminal portion of it. Now, the Supreme Court went a step further, and they said, now, listen, wait a minute here. How about the insane people? And the state says that if you're not educated, you're likely to turn out to be insane. So they took a look. And they went to every insane asylum. They went to every mental health facility. They went to all the psychologists and psychiatrists in Wisconsin I could find. They could not find one single insane Amish person in the entire state. And they looked. Hell, they went everywhere. They're trying to prove their point. It's our contention that if you're not educated, you're going to become insane or criminal. And the Amish people said, no, that's not true. And so the state people said, hell, we'll just go to the insane asylums and we'll pull out a bunch of Amish guys and show you how crazy these Amish people are. And here's the crazy part of it. It wasn't that the proportion of Amish people in the insane asylums or the proportion of Amish people in the prisons was lower than the general population. Hell, they couldn't find one. Not a single one. That's the amazing thing. So the third category that they had over here was paupers. They said, hell, if you're not educated, you're going to end up unemployed. You know, you're going to end up on the welfare rolls. So they went out into the community, and they're looking for Amish people on the unemployment rolls. And then they look high and low. They said, you know, these people are going to have a higher rate of unemployment because they're not educated. I hear that all the time. You got to go to college, because if you don't go to college, you know, you're not going to be able to get a good job. Why, you won't be able to make a living if you don't go to college. No, I didn't go to college. I don't have any problem making a living. I'm not complaining. No, I'm not opposed to college. I'm not sitting here telling you that if you go to college, you're going to end up being unemployed. But I've never been unemployed a day in my life. I drew a lot of unemployment checks. But that wasn't because I was unemployed now. And, you know, when somebody's unemployed, they're saying there's no more work. All the work has been done. I don't believe that for a minute. You people that believe all the work has been done and you're unemployed, you've never been out on the farm. There's no unemployment here on the farm. So anyway, they looked all over. They couldn't find any Amish people drawing unemployment benefits. Couldn't find a single one. They looked there. Hey, are you employed? No, I'm unemployed. Are you Amish? No, I'm Catholic. Hey, you, are you unemployed? Yeah, I'm unemployed. Well, what religion are you? Well, I'm a Methodist. You can find lots of Christians over there, you know, Methodists and Baptists and Catholics that were unemployed. Couldn't find any Amish guys that were unemployed. So the fourth category, the last category over here, was how many of them are on the welfare rolls? No, as a result of being unemployed, well, the only other alternative is you got to find these people. They're on welfare. They're drawing aid to families with dependent children. I notice, I got to put a little parenthetical in here. I notice that the Mormons who practice polygamy, nearly all of them are on welfare. Mormon polygamists, they're all on welfare, living off the state. They want five wives, and they can't feed, clothe, and house any of them. Now, there might be some Mormon polygamists out there that are not on welfare. I wouldn't say that there's not any, but most of them, and nearly all of them that I've come in contact with. And the ones that the state is prosecuting that you hear about, hell, those guys are all on welfare. Not the Amish. Not that they practice polygamy anyway. I don't think they do, but the Amish people, they went out in Wisconsin now. I don't know about Ohio. I can't tell you about Pennsylvania. You know, maybe half the Amish population of Missouri is on welfare. I don't know. But they looked up in Wisconsin, and they were trying to prove a point, and they were looking hard. And they looked all over the state from stem to stern, top to bottom. They could not find a single Amish man. Now, take a look at this. And they're looking for criminals, unemployed. They're looking for insane and welfare. And they looked all, couldn't find a single one. Now, the Supreme Court came back. They had an observation here in the footnotes of the case. You'll see this in Yoder versus Wisconsin. In fact, I got the citation here somewhere. Let me see if I can flip the page here. See if I can find Yoder for you. Here it is. Yoder versus Wisconsin, 406 U.S. 205. 406 U.S. 205. Hell of an instructive case. Yoder versus Wisconsin. The Supreme Court came back and they said, look, the objective of education is to prevent criminality, to prevent pauperism, paupers, to eliminate the poor. It's the purpose is to make people mentally well-balanced and to keep them off the welfare rolls and to eliminate murder and crime and so on. And so they asked the question rhetorically in reverse. Well, now, of all of the people who are locked up in the prisons of Wisconsin, how many of them have attended public school? And the answer was all of them. All of them. Every single one of the people who were locked up in the penitentiaries of Wisconsin had been, past tense, subjected to public education. Now, that doesn't prove that everybody that goes to public school ends up being a criminal in prison. But it proves this. The public school doesn't prevent criminality. You might argue, well, it doesn't promote it. Well, it sure as hell doesn't prevent it. So your argument falls right on its face that the attendance of public school is necessary to prevent crime. That's poppycock. I mean, anybody that isn't brain dead could figure that out by looking at the statistics. And by the way, Montgomery points out here, he says, what are you going to do? Impeach the census? Well, what are you going to say here? Is that you can't trust the census figures? No, these census takers have been running around here poking their nose in our business, for years and years. I don't give them the information, but they've been doing that. Most people give them the information. So based upon their statistics, 1850, 1860, 1870, 1880, guy writes a book 6 years later, 1886, says here's what the numbers tell you. As they say down at the card room, read them and weep. Now, in the second group over here, we're talking about insanity. They found out that you don't find any Amish people in the insane asylums. Now, maybe there's a bunch of crazy Amish people. I'm sure that most people would look at these Amish people, the way they live their lifestyle, and say, these people definitely are insane. I don't know. You tell me what insanity is. I'm not Amish. I don't intend to join the Amish. But I can tell you that the Amish got something going for them that the rest of us don't. Because they didn't have any insane people in the insane asylum, so they went and they asked the question this way. They said, well, of the people that are locked up in Wisconsin in your mental hospitals, how many of them went to public school? And the answer was all of them. Every single one. They couldn't find anybody in the mental hospitals or in the prisons and jails that had not been to public school. The argument is, if you don't attend public school, you're going to end up in prison or the insane asylum. And the Amish people don't attend public school past the 8th grade. And I think if they had their druthers, they probably wouldn't even waste their time doing that. But all right, now they took a look at the unemployed, and they said, well, of the people in Wisconsin who are unemployed, how many unemployed Amish people are there? And the answer was none, zero. Well, are there any people in Wisconsin who are unemployed? Yes. Well, of the people who are unemployed, how many went to public school? And the answer was all of them, every single one. They couldn't find any unemployed who was illiterate, who had never attended public school, or hadn't attended public school to the age of 16. And then, of course, there's a final category over here. How many of them are on welfare? Same thing. Couldn't find any that were on welfare among the Amish. Everybody on welfare in Wisconsin had been to public school. So the Supreme Court came up with a novel conclusion. They said, looks like in these four areas where we are attempting to address these social problems, the Supreme Court recognizes that criminality, poverty, insanity, and unemployment are social problems that need to be addressed. And they came to the conclusion that the Amish have addressed those four problems and solved them. And that public school obviously was not necessary for them because they had already achieved that goal. And then added that maybe the public school officials of Wisconsin could learn something from the Amish. I'd like to second that motion. What is it that we could learn from the Amish? What is it that these Amish people are doing? How are these people, these Amish people, living their lives that's different from what we are doing? That eliminates unemployment, eliminates insanity, eliminates criminal behavior, eliminates poverty. What are these people doing that eliminates those four social evils or social ills that we aren't doing? All right. Now you can sit there and say, the public school doesn't cause these four ills. Well, Zach Montgomery says they do. He goes on to show, and I'm going to point that out as we progress along, the public school is in fact a school of crime. It exists for the express purpose of teaching the students criminal behavior, and they in fact do just that. They teach the students criminal behavior, and many of those students turn out to in fact be criminals. They teach those students to be unemployed, and in fact many of those students do end up being unemployed. They teach those students the principles of poverty, and many of those students do, in fact, become poverty-stricken. And they teach those students the principles of insanity, the modalities. They instill in them the modality for insanity, and many of those students do become insane. What is it that the public schools are teaching or are failing to teach which creates these four social ills? Now, I'm talking about the public school system, because we don't have that problem to nearly that degree in the Catholic schools, parochial schools, home schools. But we do have it in the public school. So what is it about public school that's different from homeschool, parochial school, Something's got to be different. Now, it is true that students that go to homeschools, parochial schools, and Catholic schools do end up, many of them, some of them, unemployed, criminals, poor, and insane. That is true. There are people, Catholics, that go to Catholic school and end up in those four categories. But nowhere near the proportion as the general population attending public school. Nowhere near. Not even close. And the same thing is true with all of the other religious groups, even the military irreligious groups that are being sent to parochial school. And, of course, the Amish, which we have just covered. Now, why is that? Well, Zach Montgomery, in the last chapter, which we'll do here in segment number 7, points out here's what causes it. Here's the cause and effect relationship. Here's the connecting link. Here is the smoking gun. There is a cause and effect relationship, and it has directly to do with morality. And morality has to do with law. And the Bible is a law book, and the Bible has a system that the southern states were practicing back in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s that's different from the public school system of New England. In fact, the Amish people practice biblical principles that came from Moses at Mount Sinai, that if they're followed and if they're practiced, will produce less criminality, less poverty, less insanity, and less unemployment, those four big social ills, if you follow those biblical principles. What are those biblical principles that are being practiced by the Amish, the Catholics, the other religious groups, and the parochial schools that are not being practiced in the public school? Something's got to be different. We'll take that up as we progress. We're about out of time, so I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hours are 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Your time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.